This week on The Inside Flap.
And I remember years ago, I was on a London Underground and there was this guy sitting opposite me, and he had started, he was really smartly dressed, and he was going green and he was looking iller and iller. Oh. And I thought, oh my God, he's going to vomit. And everyone was looking at him askance and he was sweating. Yeah. And he picked up his briefcase, put it on his lap, opened it up and threw up into it. And then he closed it and just got off the train at the next stop. And nobody said a word.
Wonderful seats. Like, they would have been fantastic seats. And my 10-year-old found there were VIP tickets available.
Wow.
You mean Peter got online and bought the VIP tickets?
Pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, man. But, I mean, how are you going to say no?
Well, by saying no, yeah. And by canceling the charge. That's so he bought 5 VIP tickets.
Yeah, like 300 and some bucks each.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado, this is the Inside Flap Podcast. Thank you so much for joining us today. My name is Dave Medicus. And welcome to the show. Seated across the snack shack to my right is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
Howdy. And tugging on the cords and almost pulling them off. We'll see if we can get through this technologically intact. To my left on the floral settee is Andrew Dowd.
Excelsior.
Welcome to
The Inside Flap.
Got a great show. You know, I should say the needing glasses, Andrew Dowd, is right before we were getting ready to record, and he's looking down as we're back out in the snack shack in the backyard. He's looking down at the ground and he says, "Oh, that's a brown recluse spider. Do you want me to step on it?"
Yeah, what was it?
No, I said, "Is that a brown recluse spider?"
Either way, as I looked at it from across the room, I said, "No, that's a moth."
I think the angle... Like, looking straight down, it looked like a spider with all its legs pulled in.
There are a lot of bugs in the snack shack.
Yes. Brown recluse spiders, though.
I hope not. Point out.
We got a great show for today. We're joined once again by Claire Pooley. You know her from her blog, Mommy Was a Secret Drinker, which has nearly 3 million hits. Her memoir, The Sober Diaries, was published in 2017 to great acclaim. We talked with her about her new book, Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting. It is out now. A fantastic book. Great guest. Wonderful chat with her, and we'll have that for you in just a second, along with our
book reviews,
book recommendations, and, of course, the
audio book
of the week. But first, Andrew and I, as we record this on an early Sunday morning, had a late night last night. Now, Laura, you and I have been to lots of concerts together. We've seen Green Day was a great concert. We saw, who else?
Listing the concerts we've seen? There's a lot. Sure.
I mean, Taylor Swift. Okay. Had some great Taylor Swift shows. I'm just leading up to it. And Andrew and I last night went out and saw, of course, you won't get no dessert
till you clean up your Weird Al.
You might recognize him from Andrew Dowd's walk-up music for his book recommendations. But yes, the Weird One, we saw Weird Al. Fun show here in Denver. Really, really good time to be had by all.
Yes, yeah. And it wasn't just Dave and I. It was my 7-year-old daughter my 10-year-old son.
And listening to Weird Al music on the way up to the show and on the way back. So, you know, it's good when you can get
the
new generation interested. And the kids were really into Weird Al. And
that's great.
It was a good family show. Now, I want to start, and Andrew was kind enough to give get VIP passes for everybody. So we got early entrance.
Yeah, and I don't know. It wasn't me being nice. It's the fact that my family has access to my credit card. And so And so one time, you know, my family, my 10-year-old son found out that there were VIP tickets online.
No, oh. You are kidding me.
No.
Because you had regular tickets.
We had already bought
then,
tickets. We bought then, first row tickets in the upper balcony.
Mm-hmm.
The first balcony, the parterre or whatever mm-hmm. it's called. Wonderful seats. Like, they would have been fantastic seats. And my 10-year-old found that were VIP tickets available.
Wow.
You mean Peter got online and bought the VIP
tickets? Pretty much, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
But, I mean, how are you going to say no?
Well, by saying no, yeah. And by canceling the charge. That's five so he bought five VIP tickets.
Yeah, like 300 and some bucks each.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay, and... This is not a math podcast, but I think any listener out there is able to do the math on that one. Anyway, you know, we had a little, they had a little Jeopardy, Weird Al Jeopardy at the beginning. That was fun. Got some crowd involvement there. And then the opening act. Now listen. You can tell a lot about a performer by the, you know, the guest. Who can forget when we went and saw Lorde? I mean, do you remember her opening act?
Yeah.
Was Run the Jewels. Unbelievable. So much fun. So Weird Al, his opener was the 66-year-old Emo Phillips. And I don't know if any of you out there were around in the 80s when Emo was big, but you'll remember he's the comic who talks like this. And you'll be happy to know his act has not changed, nor has his haircut.
His real hair, yes. Isn't it?
He's got the Prince Valiant haircut.
Does he mention the haircut?
He mentioned it. Yeah, yep. Quickly made some kind of haircut joke.
Do you think he's married?
Oh, like half of his shtick was dissing his wife.
Yeah.
Really?
His ex-wife.
His ex-wife.
Yeah. So you wonder, mm-hmm. like, if there's any truth to that.
But seriously, that's
a lot of old comic shtick that used to be their shtick back in the day.
Right. And it's still, well, you just hit upon the emo's act. You can start anything with the emo why saying back in the day.
And I'm just wondering today if I'm going to get questions for my kids, because some of what he said was not appropriate for kids.
Really?
Oh, no. I won't get into details, but I'm just like...
It was nothing outrageous.
What's his last name again, Dave?
Emo Phillips.
Oh, Phillips.
As like Busy Phillips. He, at one point, though, he would hold up, I guess, part of his act is the quote-unquote greeting cards. I made a Mother's Day card. And he'd pick up like a binder, and he'd open up the binder so we could read. I guess if you were in the first two rows, you might be able to read the words on it. It's just a white piece of paper with words on it. It was really strange.
And that had to be the most unsophisticated prop I've ever seen in my life.
It's just a blue binder with some words on a white piece of paper. My greeting cards. And then
he's a strange guy.
Oh, he's very, very strange. Very strange. But after him...
Pee-wee Herman-esque?
Yeah, in that same ballpark.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So you just don't know.
Like, kids, don't go near that guy.
You wouldn't want, no. There was no meet and greet with Emo Phillips.
Yeah,
and if
God.
There were, I don't thank think God. We'd bring Peter or Mary Kate to the Emo Phillips.
But he's like Pee-wee Herman without the theater annex.
Yeah. Huh. But the nice thing I will say is that they kept the show moving. Emo took the stage immediately. And
you
then
said
there
he was
like
making fun of Scientology?
It was.
I feel like that's you got to be careful with that. If you take your act on the road to California, they're going to show you the door.
Maybe he doesn't do those jokes in California.
Oh, maybe.
He made fun of other religions too.
Oh, okay. So, all right then.
Yeah. But I mean, Scientology, it just shows you his act. I mean, how long has Scientology been a thing?
That was like
in the news back when Tom Cruise was into it, you know.
Oh.
So I'm guessing those jokes were recycled. Just old jokes, yeah, was my point.
What a strange guy.
Very strange, but it was like 5 minutes, and then Weird Al was taking the stage. And by
You didn't have to wait very long?
No, did not have to wait long.
That's nice. I feel like it's a chore to wait for people.
Right, it can be, but no,
always
he was right
is.
Out there. I think the main thing is Weird Al probably had to hit the bedtime, and not only Weird Al, but his guitarist, or the bass guitarist who sat next to him, who must have been, I mean, he was 75 if he was a day. The keyboard player also sitting down. Weird Al sitting down. Did not...
Never heard of Keith Richards?
Did not stand up. The 62-year-old Weird Al, not doing any standing. And then you had next to him...
We saw like a 76-year-old John Prine strutting around.
Oh, we saw that. We sure did. There was an empty stool for his guitarist, because I guess his guitarist had COVID.
Oh.
And the weird, also the drummer was completely wrapped in plastic.
Oh, yeah. Was he?
For some reason. Like, that's really going to help you.
That's cute.
But there was just a stool for the
guitarist. Was it to help with the sound, though?
No, you never saw for the drummer. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know.
And maybe, but I would think
I'd never seen it before.
I would think not because plastic, like,
it just ricochets off.
And that's it. Thin plastic can't have much of an acoustic effect.
No, that's true.
Yeah. So he said Weird Al was like, yeah, our guitarist got COVID, so he's downstairs on his axe. But I don't really know where Andrew and I were speculating. Andrew was saying maybe he's sitting at home in his underwear playing from there, but. We never saw the guitarist.
Yeah. Oh, but you could hear him?
Yeah.
You could hear him. He played.
And Al, like, performed as if the guy's there. You know,
right.
The guy did a solo and everything.
He would gesture to him and say, give it up for Jim. Blah,
that's
blah,
actually
blah.
Really funny.
And his empty stool was there.
Yeah. That's kind of funny.
It was kind of funny. It was kind of funny. But listen, when you think about Weird Al, you realize the guy has had this guy has had a ton of hits, massive hits. You start with Another One Rides the Bus. Of course, the aforementioned Eat It, you know. White and Nerdy, Smells Like Nirvana, Party in the CIA. Are you familiar with this
one? Not familiar with
the CIA. I Love Rocky Road. Now, of course, he didn't play any of those because, you know, why would you want
well,
to go
Andrew
to a Weird
had speculated
Al?
It might have been royalty.
Well, and I wonder about the royalties. That's like one thing.
I'm sure he's gone on tour before with his hits.
Yeah.
But this one was an over 150 dates on this tour. But he was just playing his original songs, and then he did a little quick hit of a quick medley at the very end.
And he's got a big is it Netflix with?
I think it's Roku. I think
with
Roku TV. Yeah.
So Roku has a TV. I didn't know.
Who knew? I think. Well, this is going to be
the big
launch out. The big rollout for Roku TV, and one of the things is this Weird Al biopic starring Daniel Radcliffe.
That could be big.
So, you know, it could be. It could be.
Yeah. Hulu did the big rollout with Handmaid's Tale.
That's right. Kinda. Now, the audience did take its cue from Weird Al in that they also sat down for the entire show. Like, every once in a while, you'd see someone get up, and I think, oh, here they go. They're getting in. But it was just to let somebody out to use the bathroom.
Well, it was an audience. What was the makeup of the audience? Like, young and old?
You look at Andrew and I. Okay. That's what you're looking at. There's the audience.
We were probably about the coolest people.
See, and that's saying something.
You think of a bunch of overweight computer programmers, and that's probably 80% of the audience.
Now, did they have their kids? Like, you guys had Andrew's kids with you?
No, not really.
Was it just a bunch of old white men?
Pretty much. I don't know if these
middle-aged white
were able
men.
To,
sorry.
For goodness gracious!
Why you have to be able to get a wife to have?
Oh,
kids.
Oh, so. I get you now. I hear what you're saying.
And I would say some of the younger single guys in there. I'm sitting there thinking these guys are gonna be single for the rest of their lives.
The rest of their lives.
Yeah, a lot of
Justin Brandon. Shout out.
Oh, that's the best detail.
Am I wrong?
You are not lying, my friend. You are not lying. Now, of course, the real highlight was afterwards, since Peter was kind enough to buy the VIP passes.
Oh, thank you, Peter.
We got to do the meet and greet, which first, so they get everybody who has the passes after the show and all the regular schlubs have cleared out. If you have the VIP pass, they stick you in a section towards the back. And they say, all right, come on back here. And there's like five rows, like 100 people. So you got like five rows, about 20 people in each row. And I said, now listen, Weird Al's going to be backstage. And then they gave us masks. So even Weird Al had COVID 2 weeks ago. But you got to mask up if you want to meet Weird Al. So they hand it out.
Fair enough.
It's fine. Absolutely.
If I was touring and I'm earning a lot of money touring and I don't want to disappoint fans, I'd want to make sure I didn't get sick again.
Let's back it up, though.
Yeah.
So when we were getting ready to get in, you actually had to present vaccination cards and or have had a booster. A test.
This was a bit of a surprise for us because we've been... You know,
we haven't had to do that.
Games where they stopped looking for that. So luckily, we still had the pictures.
You know, but as I'm looking through my wallet, thinking, man, I hope that damn card's still.
Oh, yeah.
I hope it's still in my wallet.
Yeah.
You know, you wonder, but there are a few empty seats around us. But I wonder how many VIP people had tickets, but didn't meet the requirements to actually get in.
I'm sure they would have found a way. I mean, for $300 a pop. But anyway, so then you go back there, and they shuffle you through this line, and the first time is just to get a quick picture. Now, the interesting thing is, they told us, they prepped us for this. He said, you're going to go back there. Weird Al's going to be behind plastic, but you're going to stand next to this sheet of plastic, and it's like, you know, like a wedding tent, like the plastic, the cheap plastic that zips up, that comes down and see-through, but yeah. It's pretty thick. Mm-hmm. That's what they got there. So you go back there.
Or construction. I see it on job sites.
And he's like a wax dummy behind this plastic, sheet of plastic. You walk up real quick, hit the spot, and they take the picture, and then they say, now we haven't got our pictures yet. But
oh,
they say,
I want to see the picture. Oh.
They digitally remove the plastic, so it looks like you're just standing next to Weird Al.
Oh.
So we'll get those pictures, I think they said, within 24 hours. So
that's cool.
On the lookout for that.
27 hours.
They did say 27
now,
hours.
How did you stand next to him to make it look like you were...
Well, I just pointed at him and gave a big... I looked at the camera, I pointed at Weird Al and smiled.
Okay.
People didn't really know what to do because it's awkward.
Yeah.
So you walk up. I like walked up, gave him a nod and a smile, and he like nodded and smiled, and then... We're both staring at the camera in front of us
okay. With
the sheet of plastic beside it. And then Mary-Kate, and he did Weird Al. I'm looking forward to seeing these pictures. Like, he did a funny hand gesture with Mary-Kate. And he was trying on all kinds of different poses. It was the one time where I did see Weird Al off his feet, now that I think about it.
Yeah. Now...
So he did. He does. He can move.
Is he heavy set or is he thin?
No, he's rail thin.
Ooh.
Rail thin.
Hmm.
So, and I wouldn't say rail thin, but he's not... Okay,
did he not look healthy, rail thin? The way you said rail thin, I think of someone who's unhealthy looking.
He did not. He looked, well, we got up at the very end. So, and I'll get to that in a second. So that was, you get your picture taken, and then you go back into the theater, you sit down, and then they shuffle you through the line again. And this time is to get your poster, and you get your poster signed by Weird Al. So
it's a great poster. I like it.
Yeah, it's going to go in my classroom behind my desk, and it'll be a lot of fun.
You're going to frame that, Dave? We should get a frame for that.
Sure, you can do that for me.
I'll take
the measurements.
Peter will take care of that.
So we go through the line again, and I gave my and I prepared a little material.
Sure,
you want to have something to say. So
I would have too. If I had to meet somebody famous, I'd prepare
something. So I had a little shtick, and the thing is, when you go up there, he's got his handler next to him, and he's sitting there with his pen signing, and so they gave us little name tags, so he knew what name to sign. But the guy standing next to him, and as we walk up, he says, okay, now we have John, that's J-O-H-N.
Oh.
And then anything John would say, like, hey, Weird Al, been a big fan. John's been a big fan. So I don't, and it was kind of weird, I don't know if Weird Al has hearing problems from years of, or maybe it's because we had masks
on.
It's the mask, and he's older. Was,
but everything that we said, and I walked up, and here's my, tell me what you think of this one. I said, hey, Weird Al, big fan. Well, first I said, you can smile now. This is the end of the line, which got no response from him.
Oh.
He was busy signing. That's Dave, D-A-V-E, as he's busy signing away. But I said, hey, I've been a big fan ever since I saw you in The Naked Gun.
And that got absolutely no reaction.
He said, oh, that's great. I'm going to make sure to sign yours extra special. And then he just wrote the same thing he wrote on everything. But the handler said...
so that was the best you could come up with?
Well, I wanted to show that, you know, you want to get something different. You want to have something different.
All right,
and he has a little cameo in the movie. But the handler was like, oh, wow, really?
Oh, the handler was excited.
Yeah, and he's like, that's how you got your introduction to him? And I was like, no. There was awkward silence, and I grabbed my poster and I
Now, I was literally the last person.
Yes, you were.
At the end of the night, because we all used the bathroom, so we were literally at the end of the line, and I was the last person.
Yeah.
So I would say Mary-Kate was absolutely starstruck. She was just staring
at
me.
Was she really?
Like a deer in the headlights.
And the handle was like, do you have anything to say to him, sweetie?
Oh, Mary-Kate.
And she's like, so cute.
Now, Al has he has a daughter, so I think he likes like the young little girls, you know?
Oh, dear. Be careful how you say this.
I don't mean it like that.
Drew?
Let's not isolate
in a good way.
Here's what I will say.
In a good way.
I think that most normal adults who have children...
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you see someone like a Mary-Kate, your heart melts a little bit.
Right.
They're very cute.
Anytime you have a cute kid up there.
And Mary-Kate was probably the cutest kid.
She's very cute.
At the entire assembly.
I'm sure she was.
Well, she was the only kid. You, her, and Peter were pretty much the only
There were a couple. There were a couple other ones, but they were probably a little bit older. But, you know, and what I said when I get up there, and I'm the last person, I said, Al, I've been listening to you growing up. I said, now my kids listen to you. And I basically said, you know, it's just a great gift. There's no greater gift than for us as a family to be listening to you. Mm. And he, you know, he looked me in the eyes and
that meant something,
so
Dave.
He looked up because he never looked up for me. Did he really look up?
For me.
I need to know.
Oh, absolutely. No. He looked me in the eye.
He looked up.
And I gave him like a hand on the heart gesture. But the thing is
on the heart. Well,
I just wanted him to know that
that's
how
you get him, Dave.
That his entertainment meant something.
Well, that's true.
Yeah.
That's good. And you've been a huge Weird Al.
Weird Al's a family guy, too. He's family friendly on purpose.
Yeah,
you
never
know?
Has dropped an F-bomb. Never in his life has dropped
he
an F-bomb.
He does that stuff on purpose. So Andrew's saying that probably did get him. That's true. And you say Naked Gun.
Yeah, I loved it. Where he had like a 2 second.
Which he doesn't even remember, probably.
Right, and the joke, it actually kind of makes fun of him, really, when you think about it, which I was thinking about it later. I was like, oh, that's really not.
That's so you.
They're here to see Weird Al. And then he gets off.
I don't know that makes fun of
Weird. I don't think it makes fun of him.
But I'll say this is it's 137 tour dates. And, you know, the amount of effort that Weird Al goes to
for his fans. Looked exhausted.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He
looked
dead is on. He in the middle
like,
or towards
maybe
the end?
If you're 62,
sort
you
of
don't,
in the middle.
You don't sign up. Well, Andrew's got the shirt on. Actually, we could if you stood up, we can look on the back to see where
he
is.
Oh, that's okay.
But maybe if you're
Andrew
62 years old, you don't book yourself for a 150 date tour. I mean,
I wonder what
he looked exhausted.
He did, huh?
Exhausted.
Well, you know, he had just gotten over COVID.
COVID, too, and that takes some time to get over.
That could be why he was sitting down.
Well, that, you know, maybe that
could I bet that was
might
it.
Might be onto something.
And for what his schedule is, there's no time to recover.
No.
You know?
You got to keep going because you're going to disappoint fans. Yeah.
Yep.
And lose some money.
Good point. That could have something to do with
it. I bet he's making a killing then because he only has himself and, what, three guys up there?
Oh, now here was the first. And that's all he's got. Because they didn't even have a video screen.
Oh.
No video screen. No, they had the lights, but no, like, pyrotechnics.
I'd say the music was excellent. I mean, the keyboardist... The
keyboardist was a dead ringer, and I was thinking about saying this to him too. The keyboardist was a dead ringer for Philip Baker Hall.
Oh, really?
He looked exactly like Philip Baker Hall.
One's Philip Baker Hall? Heart 8?
He's the guy who's always at
Looks
Heart 8.
Looks like he's a smoker.
Yeah.
Okay, I know who he is.
He was the library policeman.
I know who he is. Yeah.
Look, did you not notice that?
Is that the guy that also plays like the gangster?
Well, he did look like that guy, Steven Van Zandt. Right.
Yeah.
He did look
that's
like
what
him
I was thinking.
Too. He looked like him too because he had the Steven Van Zandt haircut. Yeah.
But you know, but the music was excellent. I mean,
the music was so good that I had my phone out and Andrew and I both had our phones out, right?
Yeah.
And then when you go to a concert, you grab some videos,
some
take
snippets. Yeah.
So we're up there taking pictures, taking videos.
Yeah.
And then there's a guy coming from the front and you notice him because, again, everyone's sitting down. So this guy starts walking down the aisle.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think anything of it. I'm still recording. And then all of a sudden, I feel this hand on my shoulder.
Oh.
And the guy is leaning over and he's yelling at me about my phone. And I was like, oh, all right. And I quickly put my phone away.
At a stand-up.
So one of the things I wonder is, if you look on YouTube, somebody recorded, like recently, this tour. They recorded the entire concert and put it on YouTube.
Concert.
And so I wonder if that's the last thing
you can look up any musical.
Yeah, but you know what I've heard?
Find all kinds
stand-up
of
stand-up comics like
no,
they don't do that any. They take your phones.
They confiscate phones. Yeah, absolutely. Stand-ups do. Yeah. Well, you think the Emo Phillips was behind? They need to put the phones away.
I'm just wondering if that's a thing.
I don't know.
I get distracted, like, you know how Voss, you're throwing back to a couple episodes ago where she was yelling at parents?
She literally said to the parents, you're ruining it for everybody.
I'm fine with parents recording their children's thing.
You're ruining it for everybody.
I do, like, it is a little distracting when you look at, when you're at a concert and all you just see is phones.
That's true. But, yeah, maybe... What if you say you had the phones out for the first two? Because you want to share the experience with your friends and say, hey, look, I was at Weird Al.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So when we
I
were
guess the, that's why we have this.
So in the lines, some of the people in front of us are like, hey, Al, the last time you were here, like 10 years ago, I gave you a Weird Colorado book.
That's right. You remember that?
And Al's like, oh, yeah, I remember that.
Oh, yeah,
these are the kind of people.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You remember? And remember when I said to you, I gave you that sweaty handshake? And, But anyway, good time was had by all. And hopefully next time he comes out on tour and sings the hits.
Oh, that's really funny. Well, maybe he will. Maybe he needs to recover from COVID.
That's right.
And I will say one of the songs I hadn't heard since high school.
Oh, really?
Which was the Midnight Star.
Oh yeah,
and that was and a big
I
hit.
That was. Well, we knew it.
Yeah,
we knew it.
Yeah,
we listened to Dr. Demento.
But you know, I had haven't listened to that.
But
song
you're right.
For
that one brought me back.
Oh yeah,
that
yeah,
one brought
absolutely.
Me back. And I was like, oh, I remember this song from high school. I knew all the words. And literally, you're right. It had been 30 years.
Yep.
Since we heard this song, Midnight Star.
So that was probably my favorite song of the night. Just
me
because
too. Solid hit. Yep.
I have no idea what you guys are talking about.
The memories
about.
Came flooding back. It's about a tabloid newspaper.
Dave, should we sing a verse?
No. Why don't we hand it over to Laura? Laura, how has your week been?
My week has been good. I did not go to the concert last night. I read my book.
No, we had an extra ticket.
Yeah, I don't know many Weird Al songs. I think it's a white guy
thing. It's a dude fest. It's a white guy.
And Mary-Kate.
Unfortunately, not a lot of diversity in the audience, unfortunately.
Well, I mean, he knows that, though.
Yeah, it's his audience.
Kind of
I mean, that's
it.
His audience.
Yeah, we're getting ready to leave for vacation.
So yes, we are.
I have had my head down, nose to the grindstone.
Oh, you've been plugging away.
Oh, plugging away. Got to do some work today just to get out of town. And it's just interesting because I've worked through times where we don't really have easy access to the internet, right? And I've been working for a while.
Yep.
And those vacations are really nice. Because you walk away from things.
Yep.
And now I can check into work anywhere I go. So it's like good and bad.
Good
so
and bad.
When you have a small company, you need to be doing that. You can't easily take off, you know. But
you want to make sure all your ducks are in a row so you don't have to.
I want to make sure I'm not having to check.
So we're not going when we're going to Florida and you're not going to be setting aside like chunks of time to work or anything like
no,
that.
No,
right?
No.
And I would say it's not just small companies anymore.
That's probably true.
Or your own. I mean, unfortunately, like, it doesn't matter who you work for.
Really?
Anymore. They expect you to be connected. They expect you to respond. I mean, on vacation there.
You know, that makes me feel better because I thought
no
it was.
There's no delineation.
Okay. That, I was thinking.
That is true because every time Andrew goes away to his little hops to Mexico, he's always logging in, making sure he's got his work computer and internet access.
Well, and this whole work from home thing with COVID.
It's brought that home.
It's like the connections to you and the expectations that you're going to work wherever you are. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's gotten worse. So the work-life balance is worse because of COVID.
That's true. So you guys are all like your small business owners. So you're on it all the time because it's always been like that for me.
And maybe it's like the lack of resources and the lack of productivity because people are because some people working from home are just got their feet up on the couch.
Really? Do you think that's true?
Oh, I goddamn right it's true.
Really?
I will say that week off I had as a teacher, though. I did not. I would log on to make sure my lessons were ready for the day for the sub, but I was not getting online. I was not expected to.
No, teacher's different. That is something that is different. You're not expected to do that. Yeah.
Day
that's
off is a day off.
And if you detect some vitriol in my response.
Well, we detected it.
I detected it, Andrew.
And the reason being is, you know, when I work and I see all these people. That are putting together like one slide deck a month and going around the country camping and, you know, calling in from like one campsite after. Absolutely. And it's just like.
And they're getting paid?
And they're getting away with it.
Boy, that's nice work if you can get it.
It is nice work if you can get it.
Wow.
Sorry, we're out of internet range. I won't be able to be joining. I'm going to be on the slopes of Kilimanjaro.
That's really funny.
Dial in.
I made a bunch of site visits towards the end of the week just to check on things, see how things were going. And I had one funny little story for you guys. So I'm standing outside of a house. It's almost done. Clients can move in probably at the end of June. And so final stuff, and I'm looking at her yard, and the family has been moved out of it. It's an old house in Park Hill, which is a beautiful neighborhood in Denver.
Yes.
And the yard is stunning, though, and I've only seen the yard looking terrible. So I'm commenting on it and oohing and aahing, and just beautiful little yard. But there's a beeping behind me, and it's like the sound of a car. Like when you unlock your car, sometimes your car will beep, 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 beep.
Okay, yeah.
So it's doing that and it's loud to the point where I keep kind of looking over my shoulder to make sure like there's not a machine that's backing up near me, even though it's not a steady, it's a boop, 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 boop. And she sees me doing that because as a human, you're like, oh, there's something coming. And she's like, oh yeah, there's a beeping noise that's been coming from our dumpster for about 2 months.
For two months?
Yeah. And she said her husband tried to like dumpster dive a little bit to see if he could figure out where it was coming from. And they don't know. It's loud.
What?
Yes. And she said she feels embarrassed. And like when her neighbors come out, she tries to like get away quickly so they don't like ask her about this beeping noise. And it's not a fire alarm either, because fire alarms are notorious for the one beep and then like a minute goes by.
30. Yeah. I wonder if it's something that's given like a low battery warning.
And it's constant. It is a constant beep, beep, beep. Beep, beep, beep.
Can't they just have the dumpster?
It's about ready to be hauled off. Okay. I mean, you don't want to pay unless it's full. That's true. Full.
Just for a little deep.
And it's at the end of the project.
It's going to be in the landfill soon.
Yeah. Yeah. It will be in the landfill soon.
Well, I'm guessing they're not sitting out on the front porch then with their feet up listening to the ball game.
No, but other people would be. It's a nice neighborhood. So like it's loud a tree lined.
Is it loud enough where you could hear it across the street?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. That's a tough one. So I got a good laugh out of that. So
when I first got married, I had a huge like 20-yard dumpster in front of my house.
Yeah.
And I remember,
shocker, Andrew.
And I remember I went and put some stuff in the dumpster.
Yeah.
And then I looked
down. All her things, of course.
Yeah. And I looked down and my wedding band is missing.
Oh!
I had lost my wedding band in the dumpster.
Oh.
So fortunately, it didn't actually take me that long to find it.
Wow.
But
you got lucky.
Oh, yeah, I got lucky.
Where was it?
I had thrown some materials in there,
and it was
in there with the materials.
Oh,
but
boy.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of lucky, we were lucky enough to be joined once again by Claire Pooley. Her new book is out now. It is called Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting. And Laura, why don't you tell us a little bit about this delightful book?
Yeah. So there are rules for commuting on public transportation. One of them is don't talk to strangers.
Yes.
And I would also add, be careful about who you make eye contact with, having worked and commuted in New York City.
Yeah, you got to be careful about it.
Be careful.
You can't look around.
And you learn that the hard way, because some people who are very normal looking in terms of the outside appearance are not normal.
Yes. And sometimes you just want to look around and scan the faces, but you can't.
Well,
you
can't. It's a human thing to try to connect, yeah. But you do not want to connect once you're on that train.
No.
So this is set in London, and it's with a group of commuters who've been coming in from the suburbs to city jobs for years. Mm-hmm. So the title character, who is a character herself, Iona Iverson, is an advice columnist at a magazine.
Any relation to Allen Iverson?
I'm sure.
Denver Nuggets.
His aunt, I'm sure.
Okay.
So Iona is 57, and she feels as if they're trying to push her out because of her age. So she's very age conscious.
Yeah.
And Iona
yes.
has private nicknames for some of the computers. Oh my
computers.
Goodness. It's morning.
It's because we're recording on
a morning.
I'm not a morning
person. I'm going to say this, Andrew.
Morning.
So at 57,
yeah,
because I'm starting to get to the point where I can relate to that.
I know.
But yeah, we're getting there.
I'd kind of like to be pushed into retirement. But does she need the money? I mean,
she does need the money.
Yeah.
Okay. She very much needs the money.
Well, and some people also need the work. They like the work.
She needs the money, and she does enjoy her job. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you were an advice columnist, you wouldn't want to be pushed into. I like to be an advice. No, I would not.
No, I'd hate to do that. Columnist. It would really be distressing. Mm-hmm. Iona has private nicknames for some of the commuters she sees in the train, and one day, a guy that she calls smart but sexist man spreader chokes on a grape, and he's saved by a nurse on the train named Sanjay. Yes. So after this near-death experience, Iona starts to get to know some of the commuters on this train, and this kicks off just a really entertaining journey when strangers talk to other strangers. Mm-hmm. It's very entertaining. It's a very quick read. Read it in a couple days. It's a pick-me-up, feel-good book that I recommend for summer. It's a good, you feel better about other people after you read this.
And I'm reading it right now, and it is a lot of fun. So it's quite enjoyable. And speaking of enjoyable, so was our chat with Claire. So right now, talking about her book, Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting.
See, you did it too.
I almost said computing. I'm going to blame you because you almost said Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting. Here is Claire Pooley. I believe in angels. Something good in everything I see. I believe in angels. When I go
I met you two guys with the Authenticity Project,
right,
didn't I?
That's right.
Because yeah. We used old technology then, so I think this is the first time we've seen each other's faces. But I saw your names and thought, yes.
There you go. Well, that's good. I'm glad that was your reaction.
That's better than that. Ooh.
Well, it's gonna be a long 30 minutes. No, we don't want that. No, that's good.
No.
Good.
Glad to hear that. Oh man, so Claire, I love this book. I read it in 2 days. I'm sure you're hearing that from people. It cheered me up too, because we've had such a hard time, you know, recently. And it just was like, it was one of those books where I just forgot what was going on in the world, forgot what was going on in my life. And I just immersed myself in the book. And I felt like I was a little bit of a better person after I read it, which was also a credit to you. I don't know.
Oh, what a lovely thing to say.
It might not stick. And it's a great title, which I know is an American title, but I really like it. Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting. What was it that inspired you to write this book?
Oh, well, you know, I started writing it during lockdown because I was, you know, we were all tucked away in our individual boxes, and I really missed crowds and people and spending time packed in small spaces with strangers. And I started thinking back to my commuting days. And I spent decades commuting in London on buses and trains and the London Underground. And I used to see the same people over and over again. And I used to give them little nicknames, and I'd imagine what their lives were like when they weren't on our shared commute. But we never spoke to each other. We didn't even make eye contact, because that's one of the sort of first rules of commuting in London, right? Is you never talk to strangers, and you don't even look at them. And I started thinking during lockdown, you know, what would have happened if I had talked to some of those strangers on the train, what that might that have led to? And that really was the inspiration for this novel. And I wrote it really as an antidote to lockdown. Oh, so yeah. It was all about strangers in packed together in small spaces and what happens when you break the rules and talk to people.
Yeah. And it really got me thinking, you know, this book's a lot about community and how important it is for human beings just to be around other people, even if we're not talking to them, but especially to have a little bit of engagement with other human beings that aren't our immediate family. But it is being lost with our ability to work from home, which, you know, you write in the book about hot desking. And I had never heard that term before.
Oh, how do you?
No, yeah, me neither.
Quite common here.
Is it?
Yeah, it probably is here. I just might not know it. Is that something that you think is having a profound impact on us? Because I feel like it is just serving to make us lonely right now.
I agree. I think the problem is that initially it feels liberating, doesn't it? You think, yay, I don't have to do that commute anymore. I've got all this extra time. I've got all this extra money. I can go to the gym in my lunch break. You know, I can work in my pajamas. You know, I can eat cake. You know, so it feels like it's great. But I think what we don't realize is that over time, the impact of our worlds getting smaller and smaller, both in terms of, you know, physically us not traveling around so much, but also just not seeing as many different people, as many different places. I don't think it's good for us. I don't think it's good for our creativity. Right. I don't think it's good for our mental health. And I think it will start having a real impact. I don't think we should go back to where we were before. I don't think we should go back to the obsessive, five day a week commute. But I certainly think we should do some of it.
Yeah. This book made me really kind of start to think about that. And I work from home, but I also have to go out into people's homes. So it's a little bit different. Dave's a teacher, as you can see, but you're a writer. So do you miss that as a writer, that being around other people? But I imagine you probably need to be solitary when you write.
Oh, you know, I really miss it because I find that inspiration comes from the strangest places, but it certainly doesn't come from your own kitchen. And, you know, I really noticed that during the lockdown. You know, I missed the theater, I missed art, I missed travel, all those things that give you, you know, a rich world to draw on. So I think the book very much came from that yearning. So I find that, you know, I generally work from home, but I do try and find other places that I can work from that will just give me a change of scene and you know, sort of get me out and about. Because I think staying in your, as a general rule of life, staying in your comfort zone is very attractive, but it's not healthy.
No, it's not. I'm glad you give the theater a little shout out. And sometimes I feel I come in here, I interact with over 100 kids a day, so it's a little too much at times. It's a little bit too, so we gotta,
but it keeps you young, right?
It does, and that's a great thing, absolutely. And I tell these kids all the time, they're like, why are you a theater teacher? What is wrong with you? I mean, there's a million things you can be. I'm like, no, this is great. I come in here, I play, and interacting with kids and find out the kind of music they're listening to and movies they watch, it does. It keeps you young. It keeps you on your
just
toes.
Just like what Iona said in your book, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So she wants to go to work so she knows what the kids are watching on Netflix.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I think especially as we get older, it's very tempting to stay in that comfort zone. But it's... Yes, it keeps it out and about, keeps you young.
Yeah,
it really does. And connecting with people younger than you, people who aren't like you.
Yes.
Right. Awesome. And I like you were mentioning the nicknames. One of my favorite nicknames in the book was Smart but Sexist Manspreader, which I just slapped my knee at. Now, and my real, what I was dying to ask you, Claire, is so you wrote this book and you talked about how we need to get out and talk to strangers. Claire, have you put your money where your mouth is? Do you get on the train now and start blabbing to people next to you?
No, of course I don't. I'm British.
No, I
still haven't. And you know what was funny? I was, you know, when I was writing this book, I was trying to think what would happen that would get people out of that British reserve. You know, what would make them connect with the fellow commuters? And I remember years ago, I was on a London Underground, and there was this guy sitting opposite me, and he was really smartly dressed, a bit like a smart but sexist man spreader. Really smartly dressed. He had a sort of leather attache case, and he was going green, and he was looking iller and iller. Oh. And I thought, oh my God, he's going to vomit. And everyone was looking at him askance, and he was sweating. And I think he'd obviously had a really big night the night before.
Right.
Yeah.
And he picked up his briefcase, put it on his lap, opened it up and threw up into it. And then he closed it and just got off the train at the next stop. And nobody said a word. And I thought, well, if vomiting on the commute is not enough to get people talking, what would it take? That's why we had the near-death incident at the beginning. I think in that instant, I would start talking to people.
Yes, I hope so. Yes. We used to live in New York,
right,
and it was taboo also.
Yeah,
I think
same thing.
Big city, you don't talk with people. I think as a young person, I made the mistake once and then realized that she looked normal, but she wasn't. Yeah.
And I've talked to people who say that they will talk to strangers on the platform, for instance, but as soon as you get on the train, you don't speak. And I think it's because you can't get away at that point. So that's why it's seen as a bit too intrusive.
It's a little dangerous too.
And elevators too. I got a buddy of mine who always, whenever he gets on an elevator, he turns to the person next to him, hey, how you doing? How's it going? You having a good day? I'm like, why stop talking to these people? It's so awkward and embarrassing.
You're right. That's weird too, isn't it? But what I love about this scenario on the train as well is the way that everybody makes assumptions about each other, and each of their assumptions are different. They each have different nicknames for each other.
Yeah.
So Iona, you know, one character calls her the Rainbow Lady because he loves the way she dresses extravagantly.
Yeah.
But one calls her Magic Handbag Lady because of the extraordinary things she has in her handbag. And Smart but Sexist Manspreader calls her Mad Dog Lady because he just thinks she's completely crazy. So, you know, they all make assumptions about each other. And as the story progresses, we learn quite how incorrect those assumptions are. And I think that's very true of life as well, is we are, you know, we do constantly make assumptions about people, and they're almost always wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they really are. And I like the intergenerational. You have a variety of ages in here, and they're all able to help each other in different ways. So the young person can help the old. It's all mm-hmm. gelled really nicely. And I wish that we had more of that. I think that churches used to give people that community, but people don't go to church as much anymore. Or, you know, maybe if you lived in a small, tight-knit community, you might get young people interacting with an adult that's not, you know, their teacher or their parent, I guess.
I think we do spend so much time these days in echo chambers.
Yeah.
You know, so if you think about, you know, my parents' generation, you know, people, you know, my mother lived in a village where everybody knew everybody else, and they were all the generations. And, you know, it was a natural sort of multi-generational community. Whereas now we often tend just to see people who are just like us, yes. Both online and in real life. So I'm intrigued by what happens when you break down those barriers. And I'm particularly, as you say, I'm particularly interested in the multi-generational thing. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that older people have the wisdom to help guide the younger people, but, you know, younger. So Iona, at the beginning of the book, we discover that she's about to lose her job because she works for this magazine. She describes herself as an it girl who's now a past girl, and she knows that they want to get rid of her because they think she's irrelevant. And actually mixing with these younger people on the commute really helps her. You know, it helps her, you know, become more up to date and see that actually she is still relevant, and she does have something to sort of, you know, something to, she is able to connect with that generation.
Yeah, that was great. And then she's I like the term agony aunt. I know Iona cringed every time you say it. An advice columnist. And in our country, we have Dear Abby, which has been around mm-hmm. ever. Do you have any favorite self-help columnists? And I was kind of curious about what made you decide to make her a self-help.
Oh, you know, I used to read those columns obsessively when I was a teenager. and actually even so through my 20s and 30s, I don't so much now. I think because, you know, with modern technology, there are sort of, you know, there are so many different places to get advice now that it's not quite as sort of, but yeah, I remember as a teenager, we had a magazine called Jackie. I don't know if it existed in the US that I read as a teenager, and they had an advice columnist called Kathy and Claire, who used to solve all your problems about boys and you know, how to French kiss and, yes. You know, all that sort of thing. So yes, I've always been I've always thought it was a fascinating job, really.
Yeah. And it's fun to read about other people's problems too. There's something.
Right. For sure. Yeah. the title. So we're going back to the title for a second here. So here, it's called Iona Iverson's Rules for Commuting. Love that. In England, you got the people on the platform.
People on platform five.
People on platform five. Apologize. Mm-hmm. I personally think it should be titled Grapes on a Train. But do you have any say on the title? Or do you have any input? Or do they just pretty much tell you what it's going to be and you roll with it?
Oh, you know, it's fascinating, isn't it? Until I started writing novels, I didn't realize that the author has very little say about either the title or the cover. Mm-hmm. That's very much the publisher's job. And it should be, in a way, because, you know, as an author, you get so close to your story that it's difficult for you to see it
right.
with fresh eyes, you That's know, true. To imagine being in a bookshop and looking at this story and deciding whether or not it deserves your money and your attention. And, you know, I can't imagine that because I've spent years living with it. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, I can't put myself in that position, whereas the publishers can. So it makes sense that they're in charge of the title and the cover. But it is interesting when different markets have completely different ideas about what it should be. And it's not just the UK and the US, it's every market pretty much has their own title.
Yeah.
So and their own cover. It's fascinating.
Mm. It really is. And I guess I'm very American because the American one appeals to me more than the other one.
I really like the American title because I like the focus on Iona herself because she's such a fabulous character, I think. Whereas I think in the UK they wanted the focus to be on the community and not just on one person. So, you know, it's just a different point of view, really.
That's true.
Well, and speaking of the title, and it's got the rules of commuting right here on the title, and Iona has about five or so rules for commuting. Did you have any more written out that you did not include, or are there any rules that you particularly ascribe to when commuting besides not talking or looking at anybody?
Yeah, I mean, her rules for commuting, I think, were my general ones. So the first one was obviously you have to have a job to go to. Right. You know, you don't want to commute without for no reason.
Yeah.
Never talk to strangers on the train. Yeah. Don't consume hot food. Very important because hot food is smelly, whereas cold food isn't smelly.
Right.
Never give up your seat once you're in it, unless there's somebody who's pregnant or somebody who is ill or infirm in some way or other. That's a really dangerous one in London as well, because what you don't want to do is give up your seat for a pregnant lady who turns out not to be pregnant.
That's
big
true.
Mistake.
Tricky. Yeah, you got to make sure. I made that mistake once. Only once.
Yeah. Well, I'm now at that age where every now and again people sort of offer me their seat. And kind of them. And I want to sort of say, you know, that's really kind. Thank you. But at the same time, I'm thinking, I don't need to sit down. I'm not that old.
Right. That's funny.
It is funny how we're here on a train, and going back to our New York days, the crazier someone acts on the train, the quieter it gets. Do you know what I mean? Nobody wants to look at if somebody comes in with they start espousing their political views or whatever, going off on some rant or some homeless person walking by. Everybody gets very crazy or very quiet, and they find some other place to look at. It's interesting how that happens.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I love about Iona is the fact that she's convinced that nobody is paying her any attention.
Yes.
So she thinks that she's sort of this invisible person and that she's one of a number of sort of completely identical commuters. And of course, they're all watching her because she's extraordinary. And they're all listening to her. So sometimes the other characters go, Iona, you know, everybody's listening. She goes, don't be ridiculous. Of course they're not listening.
Yeah.
And of course everyone is.
Yeah.
so I love that. And there's another character on the who's a bit of a secondary character called David,
mm-hmm.
Who is one of those people that nobody recognizes or remembers, and we all know those people, you know. So when you go to the school reunion and there's somebody who you were at school with for years and years and you have no memory of whatsoever, so poor old David, you know, realizes that he's been doing this commute with these same people for the last sort of, you know, 10 years and nobody knows, nobody remembers ever having seen him before.
Oh, and one of your characters writes David's name on his wrist to help remember because he feels that. And there are certain people in my life that I've not been able to remember their names like again and again and again.
Yes, same.
It made me feel kind of bad. I was like, oh, that's not good. Iona, people weren't sitting next to her also because she's a character. So there was like at the beginning of the book, there's a buffer almost always around Iona's seat.
And yet by the end,
yes,
everybody wants to be in her carriage because because she becomes like the in-house entertainment.
Right.
And I love the fact that there's a point about halfway through where she gets quite cross because she realizes that suddenly her carriage has become really crowded and she can't work out why her carriage is really crowded when the other carriages are relatively empty. And she doesn't realize it's because of her.
Always not a good, that's not something you want to realize, really.
To be fair. No.
Claire, So I'm going to quote one of the characters in your book back to you, and I ask you, what do you think of Mrs. Danvers?
Oh, that poor old Sanjay.
That was so funny.
So I've always intrigued by the idea of people finding love on public transport. And yeah. Sanjay sees this same girl over and over again, and he adores her. He adores sort of, you know, the thought of her, and is desperate to ask her out, but can't pluck up the courage. And he sees that she is reading Rebecca by Daphne du Maurier. So he goes and buys a copy and reads it. And he has the best sort of first line sorted out, which is, what do you think of Mrs. Danvers? And then he blurts it out sort of in a panic and realizes that she's actually reading Michelle Obama's autobiography. Sanjay. What do I think of Mrs. Danvers? A very misunderstood and maligned character.
Okay. All right. Fair enough.
I like that.
That's great.
I felt really bad for him. And then he realized that he kind of sounded like a stalker at that point because.
Yes. Yes. And he sort of thought there was absolutely no way he was coming back from there.
No.
But anyway, if you have to read the book to find out what happens.
That's right. That's right. No, we don't want to give any spoilers away. All right, Claire, it is time now for our segment that we call Quick Six. These are six quick questions in which we find out just a little bit more about you. Here we go. Claire, what is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Oh, and you know what? I'm so late to the party here, but I have only recently discovered Grey's Anatomy.
Oh, you are late.
Wow.
Yeah.
Claire,
and the great thing
really
about it is there are thousands and thousands there of episodes. It's so exciting. what a great show.
Yeah.
Fabulous, fabulous dialogue. More modern, Succession. So if I can have two, the old one is Grey's Anatomy. The more recent one, Succession, I totally binged on.
Oh, that's funny. Well, you know, all the kids, all the teenagers these days are watching Grey's Anatomy because they never saw it the first time.
Right.
My kids watch Friends. Same thing. You know, they've done the whole lot from beginning to end at least once.
So what fictional world or place would you like to visit?
I want to go to Hogwarts. I would really love to be at that school. I mean, there's just so much of, you know, the moving portraits, the owls, the sort of, you know, all of that. Yeah, that's where I'd like to be.
You know, which classification? Are you a Gryffindor? Are you a Slytherin? What, what's your house?
You know, everybody wants to be a Gryffindor, don't they? Because, you know, they're sort of the coolest place to be. But I like the idea of being slightly evil. I think I'd like to be a Slytherin. What about you?
Yeah.
Well,
he's a Slytherin.
No, I'm a Hufflepuff, I believe.
No, I'm Hufflepuff. Hufflepuffs are boring, Dave. That is me.
What about you, Laura?
I'm definitely a Hufflepuff. I like my home. I like my garden. I like all of that safe stuff. But I do have a Slytherin T-shirt that I like.
Ah.
Right. Well, yeah, and I wear the Gryffindor shirt to school, and my students are always like, "Oh, are you Gryffindor?" I'm like, "No, I'm not. I thought I was Hufflepuff. I guess I'm not. Maybe I need to retake the test."
Moving on,
Claire, give us one of your top five favorite movies of all time.
When Harry Met Sally.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, dialogue. Yeah. Whenever I write dialogue, I think of Nora Ephron and Harry Met Sally. You know, that is just a masterclass in the very best dialogue. I've watched that film so many times. It's just, it's brilliant.
Well, and there's another great scene with grapes when he's chewing the
yes, true, actually, yeah.
Seed and he
spits it spitting the seeds at the window.
Yeah, exactly. Billy Crystal, yeah, he spits it right onto the window. Forgot the window was closed. Yeah, classic.
That's a pecan pie scene.
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is. Yeah.
How about a top five favorite book?
Sorry, top
Top five favorite book.
top five favorite books.
One of your top five.
Always tricky because I pick books by mood. So sometimes I'll be in the mood for one sort of book and sometimes another. But I think one of the books that had the most impact on me was Jane Austen's Emma. The reason for that is because I always hated perfect heroines, you know. So Elizabeth in Pride and Prejudice, I thought was a bit too much of a sort of goody-goody. I mean, she was just too perfect. Yeah. And I loved the fact that Emma was so immensely flawed. Mm. And, you know, and I think she really influenced the way I write characters, because when I write characters, I start from their flaws and then build the character around that rather than starting from their strengths. So Emma.
That's an interesting way to start a character too. I like that.
It is, yeah. How about this, Claire? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Yes. Well, I will tell you a secret here.
Ooh, yeah.
Actually, it's not that much of a secret. I have told quite a few people.
Okay.
But when I was 11 years old, which was a very long time ago, I was in ABBA's backing group.
What?
Because there's on their Voulez-Vous album, there's a song called I Have a Dream.
Uh-huh.
And there's a little choir of little kids in the background of that song, and I was one of those children.
Whoa!
Wow! So I was just 11,
that's awesome.
And it was the most exciting thing that had ever happened to me. It's still one of the most exciting So that's my go-to karaoke song, ABBA's "I Have a Dream."
That's awesome.
That is so cool.
So cool. Yeah. So you sing good, or was it just a fluke that we would have come for?
It was a bit of a fluke. I was, at the time, I was living in Brussels. My parents moved to, my dad worked for the European Commission in Brussels. So we moved out there, and I was at the British school, and ABBA were doing a world tour, and they were playing at the big football stadium in Brussels, and they needed a choir of kids who could speak English. So, and I just happened to be in the school choir.
Wow.
So I was just in the right place at the right time.
You know? Damn, that's awesome.
Last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
I'm reading an old one, actually, that I missed when it first came out. And somebody recommended it to me. And it's one of those things I thought, why have I never read that? So I'm reading I Am Pilgrim.
Oh, I don't know that. I don't think I'm... That's
which is a thriller and is really brilliant. But I tell you the book I read just before that, totally different, is Lessons in Chemistry by Bonnie Garmuth, which... Have you read that yet?
Oh, I haven't. I'm reading it.
Oh, brilliant book.
Okay, good.
So those are my most recent reads.
Those are good.
Very good. Claire, yeah. Thanks so much for joining us. We loved your book. I
love the cover, too. It's so pretty.
It really is a good looking
cover. It definitely stands out, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't reproduce well on radio.
But, no, it doesn't. No, but listeners will have to go out and get the book to find out for
it's
sure.
It's very pretty. It looks really nice in our house, although not in Dave's theater room.
Well, I got two kids out there.
I like standing. I love the little. It's got Iona's little dog Lulu on the front, a little French bulldog, which I think is really cute.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. I do too. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. It's lovely to see you guys again.
Great to see you as well.
Thank you. Loved your book.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The Inside Flap. All right, there you go. Thank you so much to Claire for joining us once again. I liked how great is it when we get a guest to come on and say, oh, good. When I saw on my list that it was Dave and Laura from The Inside Flap, I got very happy. So that's
unless she's pulling a Weird Al on us. And
you say that to everybody. Maybe. All right, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some... Whoa! What do we got?
Huh.
All right, let's open it up.
Big fingers?
The library.
Oh, again? What are you doing?
I was just going to cut that bit.
Oh.
Yeah. All right, let's open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some...
Book reviews!
And let's start with...
Library.
Oh, where's my music, Dave?
I'll splice it in. Here we go.
Where we are, I don't know where we are.
All right, Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called Hide, H-I-D-E, by Kirsten White. So 14 strangers sign up for a 7-day-long game of hide and seek.
Whoa, what? Mm-hmm. That sounds amazing.
They sign extensive non-disclosure agreements.
Uh-huh.
They're told that it's being optimized for a reality show. The prize, though, is only $50,000.
Well,
and as you
bad.
Get to know each person, you realize these are people that are down in their luck. Some of them are not very bright. Some of them are perhaps steps away from being homeless.
So when
you think about someone who might take a 7-day hide and seek, maybe it's a reality show, maybe it's not.
Yeah.
And the price is $50,000, which we all know is $25,000 really
taxes. We all would do that math. Split it in half.
Maybe it's not. I don't know. You know. So they start their journey to an undisclosed location together on a bus.
Okay.
And it's a great scene because just, you know, in all the reality shows, people kind of pair off. They group off with their kindred spirit.
Yep.
Kind of.
Uh-huh.
It's weird how you
just
do
like Survivor.
Find.
You find.
Just like Survivor or Big Brother, all those shows. You find a person who maybe is more like you, maybe shares your values.
Yep.
Kind of interesting. So it turns out that the hide and seek game is held in a long abandoned amusement park.
Oh, that's fun.
Mm-hmm. So we know from the first flashback in the book that a child went missing there in the 1970s. And this park could not recover from that, from the bad press and the kind of terribleness that happened from that. And the park closed down in the 70s. And it's been closed ever since. And this is 2022, basically. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much set.
So the child went missing. Was the child ever found?
No.
No.
The contestants, so that sends a note, right? That's
yeah,
the opening
it does.
Scene
yeah.
is when this child goes missing.
Okay.
And then it flashes forward to present day.
Right.
So the contestants are to hide during the daylight hours inside of this park, which is kind of weird. And after sundown, they go back to a picnic shelter where there are showers, cots, and food.
Well, who's it?
We don't know who the seekers are.
Oh, okay. Oh, the seekers. Yeah.
They're calling them the seekers. Okay. We don't know who the seekers are. We just know who the hiders are.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, interesting.
Yeah. It's an odd setup. And the contestants are also wondering where the cameras are hidden because they don't really see any cameras.
Oh, right.
So they're all kind of looking around, like wondering where the cameras are hidden.
Sure.
And that's really all I can tell you because there's
a
lot of stuff that goes on.
Wow. That's what a great premise. What
it is a great premise. I read it in one day.
Yes.
It's a short, quick read.
Well, I knew it was a good book when, you know, Andrew and I, when you said you were going to watch Stranger Things.
Yeah, I was going to binge watch Stranger Things.
And instead, you binged this book.
I binged the book. Yeah, and I finished the book last night.
Yeah.
It has a little bit of a Hunger Games vibe when I was reading it. It reminded me, like that was the celebrity it most resembles.
So have you seen the Squid Games?
No.
So it's a similar to...
I know what it is about.
So some similarities to Squid Games, which... You know, it's amazing, like, how big a hit Squid Games are.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah, all my students love that show.
That's true. This is a horror book. And so, on Goodreads, I loved this book.
Yeah.
On Goodreads, the reviews are mixed. And when I looked at the bad reviews, it's from people who didn't realize it was a horror book.
Oh, okay.
And maybe she's written YA fantasy before.
Right.
And I think it's her YA fantasy was trailing her to this adult horror. And it's not that. It's not a...
And one thing we notice with horror, and even as I'm rereading Stephen King and I'm looking back at the reviews
for
his books,
it's not for everybody. It's not for everybody.
And they mark them down just because of the genre that it's in.
I know.
It's maddening.
And I really like horror. And
yeah, me too.
So I don't, but I also know that a lot of people don't.
They don't, and they, for some reason, keep reading it and keep marking books down because
of it. So this is horror, and, you know, most horror that I like anyway, and I think most horror novels are reflections of the modern world around them. So even goes back to Dracula, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. They're all reflections of the world that these writers are living in, and this is a reflection of modern day society.
Okay.
I loved it. And it's called Hide by Kirsten White. Very quick read.
That's great. And you can't go wrong with it. I remember that one of my favorite books by Richard Stark, or is Donald E. Westlake writing as Richard Stark, was set in an amusement park. And you just can't go wrong with that setting. All right.
Oh, Andrew has something.
So do you think it's intentional that, like, if it's a metaphor for real life, that we're hiding during the day and we only get to be our real selves at night?
There is... I don't want to give too much away, but yeah, there is definitely, there's a lot of like odd parables in here is what I would say. And the writer at the end of the book, she does a dedication at the end and you're like, oh.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I think I'm going to have to check that one out. That is a Hyde recommended. Mm-hmm.
Quick
by...
reading. Laura
Medicus. And my book this week is, boy, this is a good one. Dave Medicus. It is called Deer Season by Aaron Flanagan. This is a literary crime thriller with noirish tendencies. Now, listen, this book had generated just a little bit of a buzz that I didn't know about it till I was looking at the book. I found out afterwards. It's won an Edgar Award for Best First Novel, and man, does this deserve it. It is set in 1985 in the tiny town of Guthrum, Nebraska, which is a small farming community. One of those small towns where everybody knows everybody, everybody knows everybody's business, that kind of thing. So one day it is discovered that Peggy is a teenage girl and she has disappeared. And as the days pass on without her being found, suspicion falls on Hal Bullard. Hal is a guy who's been known to get into bar fights. He had a thing for Peggy and he also does not have a good solid alibi for when she disappeared. Now, the rub is that Hal is also intellectually disabled. He's able to live by himself, but not without a lot of help from the farming family that he works for, Clyde and Alma. And Alma is one of the narrators of this book. She is a strong-willed woman. Now, she actually moved down from the city. Her husband, Clyde, brought her to his hometown. And she's always was one of these people who's been seen, even though she's been there for years, but she's always been the outsider by the locals. But she takes great pride in helping out Hal. Now, the other narrator is Milo. And Milo is the missing girl's 12-year-old brother. Now, it's interesting to hear from him as he pretty much has gone unnoticed as everyone is focused on his missing sister. And we watch as he grapples with his mixed feelings about his sister and how to deal with her disappearance while trying to figure out who did it and where she went to. Now, what comes to the fore is everything that can be bad and disturbing about a small town, you know, animosity towards outsiders and anyone who might seem as a little bit different, that built-in prejudice that is evident, the gossiping, the rumors. Sometimes you think, hey, maybe it'd be nice to live in a small town where everyone's your neighbors and has this sense of community. But
they don't exist.
No, be careful what you wish for.
Especially I don't think so anyway.
When something tragic happens. That community can either rally together or it can fracture and split apart, looking for and focusing on.
Have you ever lived in a good small town, Andrew?
You know,
and we grew up in a kind of a small town.
Yeah, but what I would say is, when I lived in, we lived in Manhattan, Kansas, and I lived there for maybe I was there for. Like,
oh, you liked that,
for,
right?
For 9 months. Well,
oh,
not really.
Okay.
And the problem was, the place was so small.
Yeah.
College town also, right?
Yeah, town. I mean, that's the only thing that town's got going for it is the college. But, you know, it's just simply, I don't even want to go into details, but no, I mean, I didn't like it. And there
I don't like it either.
And there was a lot of resentment from people, you know.
If you're an outsider?
Well, not just outsiders, but people that, like, lived in that town, raised their kids.
Oh, and the kids left?
Well, no, but the small town politics.
Mm.
And just how much they control.
They hold on to it.
Like one strong personality and just how much he just skews.
That's
like
true.
The small town. But yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know, small towns. There's just some weird stuff there. Yeah.
I agree. I think that it goes even into, like, I've had bad experiences at small schools and Sylvia has too. So
again, small communities.
There's something about it. I don't know. It's easier to find your way, I think, in a bigger area with more personalities, and people are maybe a little more tolerant because they have to be.
Yeah, you could, because
you don't have to be as much in a small town.
No,
probably.
And if anybody's a little bit different, then they get noticed. So anyway, this book is extremely well written. It's a strong characterizations, an atmospheric sense of place and time. This is a book that really resonated with me. It stays with you afterwards. It's got a strong emotional heft that hits you in the final pages. And if you're like me, you might want to have a box of tissues handy. And no spoiler there. It just really just speaks to the three-dimensionality of his characters and how well you get to know the people in the book that just hits home for you at the end. So check it out. Dear Season by Aaron Flanagan, recommended by
Dave Medicus.
All right, Andrew.
Andrew Dowd.
Don't stop, make it pop. DJ, blow my speakers up tonight. I'm a fight till we see the sun.
Everybody's raising the roof here in the snack shack. I forgot to play my walk-up music.
Yes, you did, Dave.
Dang it. Next week. Next week. I'll play it when I give you my audiobook.
I love you, Kesha.
Yes. So before I start my review,
yes,
I will say we were on vacation last weekend, uh-huh. And so we went into this comic book store. Hmm. And Mary-Kate got some graphic novels.
That's fun.
Age-appropriate.
Good.
And, you know, and I tell you, like, you know you have an avid reader when the kid reads these things cover to cover, all right? And then last week, she's probably read 1,000-plus pages.
Wow.
Right? I mean,
that's awesome.
You know, so we have two kids that are avid readers. But Mary-Kate, you know, it's just nice to see her kind of have the reading bug or the reading skill.
Yeah, that's great.
Encourage that however you can. Yeah.
I don't think there's a need to encourage it.
Oh, that's great.
I mean, you know, she's just we've already ordering books online.
That's great.
And
well, that is how you encourage
yeah.
it.
That's what I mean. I also, I'm just a big, I know people don't want to hear advice, but like, let them read whatever they want to read.
Yes.
Like
exactly.
If you, maybe yeah. graphic novels aren't your thing and you think it's not appropriate, right. They have them age appropriate. They're great.
Although I am demanding that you go out and read Dear Season. I mean, we are sitting here telling people what to read. But we're just recommending.
I'm just saying. I know there's a lot of parents. Oh, Dave. That
the Weird Al COVID.
That like censor or are careful about what their kids read. Yeah. But yeah.
Especially nowadays, more and more. More books are being banned today.
I feel like they were banned when we were there, when we were kids, because in the 80s it was satanic cults.
No, we're back to banning books. We're back to banning books.
Remember that?
Yeah, well, I don't really. But
I do.
You know, but I would say
it was Stephen King's The Devil.
I can tell you when we were in the bookshop. So Katie and I were in the bookshop with the kids. Mm-hmm. They had some books there, and Katie's like, you know, this is a book that's been banned. This is a book that's been banned.
Oh.
And, you know, I'm just like, I wasn't aware of it, but, you know, I mean.
Yep, more and more.
It's right there. It's right
they're
there
taking
in your face.
There's a town, yeah. A small town.
Probably in Texas.
In Texas. Yeah. And they are, the community shut it down for a couple days. And they took books out of it.
Yeah.
They went through and took books.
This idea that parents know better than the teachers how to teach
their
kids.
Young kids and adult books.
Yeah, because they're brainwashed into
I guess. I don't know.
So,
all right.
I'm done bashing small towns. I'm sorry.
My book,
what do you got for us this week?
Is written by M.R. Forbes. I've reviewed other book or books by him.
That reminds me of the M.R. Ducks shirts. M.R. Ducks.
So, but this is M.R. Forbes, and the book is called Starship for Sale.
Ooh.
And so.
Sounds like an Andrew Dowd book.
Yep. The main character of this book, his name is Ben Murdoch. And Ben, the book opens, he's at the doctor's office with his mom. And he is a young, you know, like nerdy type guy.
Mm-hmm.
But he basically has been diagnosed with an aggressive form of cancer.
Hmm.
And he has maybe a few months to live.
Wow.
Right? And he's literally, the book opens with him at the doctor's office. He has received the news that he's expected. And... you know, and he basically has to come to grips with it, right? And so his you know, and he's sitting there, and you have, you know, all these thoughts that go through his mind, and the fact that, you know, his life, you know, because you think about your life, and you've got a runway, and you have an expectation, but there is no runway for him anymore. You know, he knows it's just a cliff, and he's going over it.
Yep.
And so, you know, of course, his best friend Matt is going to pick him up, and Matt is like the cool guy. He's a musician. You know, Matt has got everything going for him. And Matt is his good, you know, his good friend. And so they're going to go out. And Matt's quite aware of the situation. You know, but he's the good friend that everybody wishes they had. And so how are they going to celebrate? There's a new video arcade with some really cool new VR games that's just opened up. So basically Matt is springing for tickets. And he's taking Ben out to the arcade. Now, of course, in the arcade is this space battle simulation. And Ben, of course, is fantastic at VR games.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, he performs just unbelievably well in the VR simularity. So out of the blue, they leave it, And of course, they're at the bar kind of just celebrating getting a bite to eat when, of course, Ben gets a text message saying, Starship for sale.
Huh.
And so there, this book has a little bit of, you know, it reminds me a little bit of The Last Starfighter.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with that movie.
I remember I've heard of it. I don't think I've ever seen it.
Yeah, and so the premise of The Last Starfighter is that there's these video games, you know, called The Last Starfighter that show up all over the world. And basically people play the video game. Well, one young kid is playing the video game and he just outperforms everybody. He's just absolutely a star playing this video game. Well, the next thing you know, real aliens contact him, basically saying there's a real war going on, and we need you to come and fight this battle for us, right? But the video games end up being kind of the
tryout.
Yeah. I mean, they don't know, sort of the blind tryouts.
That's a cool idea.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And so this book has a little bit of that.
Yeah,
but of course, the person who shows up is like this sleazy car salesman type guy, and. You know, Ben responds to the text message, right? And he doesn't really know if it's a scam or not, but he literally has nothing to lose. So he's like, why the hell not?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so they go and talk to the sleazy car salesman guy. He's like, well, let's go see the spaceship. And so they get in the car and they go. And Ben has nothing to lose, but Ben the whole time is thinking, well, Matt's got everything to lose. Why is he doing this? But Matt is his good buddy, and he's like, he's doing this for Ben. And so, there's a little bit of that, good friend thing too going on there. And of course they get there to the spaceship and the spaceship is shaped like a robot head. They get within sight of the spaceship. The next thing you know, they're being attacked. Right. And they basically get drawn into this thing, pretty quickly. So it's a pretty, fast paced book. And it also has one of those characteristics where you go from the frying pan into the fire, into the blowtorch,
yes,
into the blast furnace,
yes,
Hell.
So, but it is a good read for the summer. It is called Starship for Sale by M.R. Forbes.
M.R. Forbes
sounds fun.
All right, and that is recommended by
Andrew Dowd,
which means it is time once again for
Audiobook of the Week,
recommended by
Dave.
Ah, there we go. Now I get to play my walk-up music. So my pick this week is called The Unwilling by John Hart, narrated by Kevin Stillwell. Now, speaking of the Edgar Awards, as I mentioned that earlier, John Hart is a guy who's won a couple of Edgar Awards. So here's a guy who knows a thing or two about writing mysteries. This is his latest. This is a great mystery thriller set in North Carolina during the Vietnam War. And it deals with really one family and how it is affected by the war. The family is the French family. And I didn't realize she was still singing. Quiet, Taylor. I'm trying to talk about the French family. Now, this features Dad. Dad is a cop and he has three sons. The two oldest sons are twins. So they both go off to Vietnam to fight. One of the twins dies in Vietnam. The other, Jason, receives medals as he's fighting in Vietnam. But when he comes back a changed person. He is a guy whose worldview has been severely damaged by what he's seen over there. And he also comes back a drug addict. The youngest son is the one who this story is focused on. He is 18-year-old Gibby. Now, he wants to hang out with Jason upon Jason's return from Vietnam, but his parents don't want him to, thinking that Jason would be a bad influence on Gibby. And much of this book focuses on how the vets were treated upon their return from Vietnam. There's more than meets the eye with Jason, who is really a torn-up person with one foot in a life of crime, and yet still who wants a best for his brother, Gibby. There is also some serial killers in the book, if that's not enough for you, one of whom is just called X. X is on death row, but he still has many connections to the outside world. He's almost like some kind of super kingpin. He pretty much runs the show in and out of prison, and his storyline gets tied into Jason's in a very interesting way. The book is emotionally moving. The story is fast-paced and fascinating. Really enjoyed this one. Let's take a listen to a clip from The Unwilling by John Hart.
Three sons and 30 years later, she was still a gift. His whole life. But she'd lost one son already. Now this. He parked in front of their house and thought, as he often did, how empty it felt. That, too, was about the war. They'd buried their oldest son, then watched his twin brother return from the same conflict only to spiral into violence, drugs, and prison. In that regard, Vietnam had killed two of their three boys, Robert with a bullet to the heart, and his brother more insidiously. Jason never talked about the things he'd done in the service of his country. But Burklow had a friend at the Department of Defense. He refused to provide details, but said once that there was war, and there was war, and that Jason had fought the latter kind.
All right, there you go. That is your
audiobook of the week.
And that'll do it for us this week from the Snack Shack in Littleton, Colorado. Thanks to Claire Pooley for joining us again. My name is Dave Medicus. Oh, looks like the quote of the week is back as Andrew's got his phone and is ready for that. We'll see you next time.
Adios.
I think my chances of getting into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame are about as good as Milli Vanilli's. Weird Al.
All right, good. I'm glad you had a Weird Al quote for us to end up. That's a good one. Good old Milli Vanilli.
Of course I don't. I'm British.